The Cutting Edge, Old Gringo at 20 Years. Innovative design has put Old Gringo ahead of the fashion curve and set boot trends for Western aficionados worldwide. As the brand celebrates 20 years in the boot business, its co-founders reflect on how passion and community have built their success. By Andrea Thorpe. As the saying goes, you can't reinvent the wheel. However, as Old Gringo Boots celebrates its 20th anniversary, the iconic boot brand has proved you can reimagine a classic with designs that captivate fans season after season. What is the secret to building a cutting-edge reputation in the boot industry? If I could say one word, passion, Old Gringo co-founder Ernie Tarrant says. We show passion in everything that we do. When you see a pair of our boots in person, you see the difference. Tarrant has been a part of the fashion industry for more than 45 years. His experience aiding in the brand development of Old Gringo from its launch in 2000. With roots in leather manufacturing, Tarrant was showcasing the line of leather jackets when the opportunity to jump into the boot category arose via a French bootmaker named Yann Ferry. I was a one-man band, so to speak, Tarrant says. I was doing everything myself, going to the shows. Ferry and I were friends. He came up to me at the WESA, Western and English Sales Association, show in 1999 and asked me if I'd like to put together a boot factory with him. He showed me some numbers on a yellow pad, and we started the factory within 9 months. With an idea and an old-fashioned handshake, the Old Gringo Company concept came alive. With no contracts attached, partnership between Tarrant and Ferry at the helm, Old Gringo became the largest handmade boot factory in the world. When we first started, we had 10 styles, Tarrant says. With help from friends overseeing Boot Barn, Cavender's, and Western Warehouse, Old Gringo had narrowed its brand focus to incorporate timeless styling, bringing forth an authentic Western look fitted with a fashion edge. After dipping their toes into the market in 2000, Tarrant and Ferry began to see momentum as word of the line's distinctive styling spread. Western fashion trends hit a peak in the mainstream around 2005, which led to explosive growth, elevating Old Gringo to the status of a household name. We could have sold as many boots as we could have possibly made, but wanted to be careful at the time because I always felt you could wear a good thing out, Tarrant says. Sure enough, the Western trend slowed down in the coming years, but Old Gringo's popularity drove forward regardless. I think people realized we truly had something special, and we just skyrocketed from there, Tarrant says. With the advancement of boot-making technology, designers now have the capability to expand into sophisticated detailing, marrying intricate patterns with exclusive leathers. What we do now is not what we did back then with simple inlay boots, Tarrant explains. The combinations we do now were never available before. The company now uses the creativity of 35 designers to stay innovative. Tarrant and Ferry have personally kept a finger on the pulse of the fashion as well, watching trends internationally to create the next big thing. We can make a style today that is so far in advance that people don't get it, Tarrant says. I'll keep showing it, and 3 years later, it hits and sells like crazy. They never believe I've been behind the line for 3 years watching it be made. We're ahead of the curve. Since the brand gained worldwide visibility, Old Gringo styles have been spotted on many a famous foot. However, it's the stories beyond the photo ops that bring authentic job satisfaction to the company's team. The stories we get from people about the day we became a part of that family, I wouldn't trade for anything, Tarrant says. The goal is to make a woman smile. I know that if I can do that, she'll be drawn to our boots. In celebration of its platinum anniversary, Old Gringo is unveiling a brand new limited edition collection boasting 20 reimagined styles inspired by the company's roots. This collection features metallic leathers in both gold and silver, accented in Swarovski crystals and studded details. Reflecting on what they hope the next 20 years will look like, Tarrant and Ferry are optimistic about the brand's prosperity. The key to their success is simple. It's all about the boots. As Tarrant elaborates, that has been the story. That has been Old Gringo for the past 20 years, and it will be Old Gringo in 20 years from now. The boots make us look good. The boots speak for themselves.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading a few articles from True West, History of the American Frontier. Here are a couple of articles from the July-August edition of True West, featuring the cover, Women of the West, Satin, Lace, and Cherry Pie, by Jan Mikkel Collins. 10-year-old Laura Fraser gazed up at the large lady in the open door. She almost filled the entire doorway, Laura later remembered. The girl had talked her mother into letting her sell magazine subscriptions to earn money for a scooter. Little did she know, however, that the woman standing before her was Big Bertha, proprietess of the best-known parlor house in Williams, Arizona. "She kind of scared me, but I gave her my best sales pitch," Laura said. "She opened up the door and scooped me inside." Laura followed the madam to the kitchen. "Now, honey," Bertha said, "you just sit down and have a piece of cherry pie while I go find my purse." Bertha was kind like that. Born Cordelia Cordy Bell Kerbo, also known as Kerbo, in Georgia in 1881, the future madam moved to Texas as a child. She grew up learning the meaning of true Southern hospitality, a trait she carried with her even after she fled the Lone Star State, following a short-lived marriage and the death of a baby. Life on the road was tough for any 17-year-old, especially Bertha, who first embarked on a career in prostitution in New Mexico Territory. While there, the girl shot a man over some unknown skirmish. Afterwards, the authorities basically ran her out of town because she was underage, according to Bertha's great-great-niece, Michelle Bowers. For nearly 20 years, Bertha traveled from place to place, apparently changing her name as often as she changed her stockings. Not until 1917 did she resurface as Cordy Kerbo in Arizona. On November 1st, she married Wiley Whitey Whited in Clarkdale. The union appeared blissful, but Bertha had dreams of her own. By 1923, she was running the Arizona Rooms in Miami, Arizona. The large wooden affair was not far from the town's most notorious brothel, the Keystone Hotel. Bertha preferred not to keep all of her eggs in one basket. In a 2012 interview, Laura Fraser Cole guessed that it was around 1924 when she met the madam in Williams, over 200 miles from Miami. Bertha may have first worked for Longino Mora in the Tetzloff Building, a brothel which is now home to a delightful bakery, bed and breakfast called the Red Garter Inn. "I was led to believe by an old-timer, Nick Otero, that Bertha was working in my building prior to getting her own house," says the building's current owner, John Holst. Laura said the Red Garter was called the Fashion Apartments when she was a girl, and that ladies of the night could be seen waving from an upstairs balcony in the evenings. Laura's memories of Bertha were quite vivid. That day at Bertha's, as she sat eating her cherry pie, another real pretty lady in a fancy housecoat visited with her. The woman asked a lot of questions about the magazine and told me she would buy a subscription too. When Bertha came back and paid Laura, the girl was instructed to go across the street to Mr. Martin's plumbing shop and tell Mr. Martin that Big Bertha said he would buy a subscription too. Martin was not interested at first, but when Laura told him who referred her, he replied, "Oh, Bertha sent you here," and promptly bought every subscription the girl had left. Later, Laura remembered seeing Bertha as she and her employees strolled down the street in their finery. Laura and her mother were sitting in the family car. Upon spotting Bertha in her red satin dress and high heels, Laura got out and started toward the women. To her mother, she said, "There comes a friend of mine. I know that lady. She is so nice and pretty. I just want to go talk to her and hug her." The girl was ordered back into the car and hid on the floor, lest Bertha see her and think she was being rude. "When we got home, my mother told me that was the end of my magazine sales," Laura said. Later, Bertha opened Bertha's House at the corner of First Street and Railroad Avenue. But she also alternated her time in Williams with visits to Miami. Both she and Whited were there in 1928, although the couple had parted some time before 1927 when Whited married someone else. Bertha, meanwhile, was running the Copper City Hotel on Sullivan Street and renting a room at the Garden Rooms, pretty much right next door to the old Arizona Rooms. Her landlord, George Downen, also dabbled in billiard rooms and pool halls, and it was he who would eventually set Bertha's heart aflutter. At the time she met Downen, Bertha was still quite busy with her brothel in Williams. She also maintained a relationship with Whited, who had relocated to Williams by the time he died of a heart attack in 1939. It was C.B. Whited, not the man's wife, who informed authorities of his death. Bertha told the census taker in 1940 that she was indeed a widow. More notable is that for the first time in official documents, Bertha's employees appeared in the census. They were 33-year-old Frankie Lamar, 28-year-old Helen Johnson, and 22-year-old Carol Wilson. Later that same year, Bertha's nephew, John Kimbo, and his wife, Jewel, came to visit from Texas. She had some ranch land, and she made him foreman, says Michelle Bowers. Obviously, certain members of Bertha's family knew and accepted what she did for a living, a rare instance in the days when most women in the prostitution profession were shunned by their relatives. John also accompanied his aunt to Miami on at least one occasion, where she warmed up her friendship with George Downen. But the man had a wife, Cora. When Cora died unexpectedly in 1946, Bertha took her place. When, where, or even if the Downens officially married remains unknown. The couple portrayed themselves as husband and wife. However, when they both left Arizona for Hot Springs, now known as Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, they may have retired, although Bertha's family believes they ran a hotel and possibly another brothel there. Their last years together appeared to have been blissful. Downen died in Phoenix in 1952. Bertha followed 3 years later and was buried next to him in Hot Springs Cemetery. Back in Williams, those who knew the well-liked madam faded into the past, along with her real name and any information about her. Today, she is simply referred to as Big Bertha, the flamboyant and friendly madam of Railroad Avenue. Jan McHale Collins is the author of several books about prostitution in the West, including Good Time Girls of Arizona and New Mexico, A Red Light History of the Southwest. Homesteaders, Heroines, and Hellraisers. It is curious how quickly one's animal instinct of survival comes to the fore in primitive lands, recalled Edith Eudora Cole in her homesteading memoir, Land of the Burnt Thigh, a lively story of women homesteaders on the South Dakota frontier. The year was 1907, and Edith and her sister Ida Mary had settled on their homestead claim 30 miles southwest of Pierre. It was a frontier saying that homesteading was a gamble. Yeah, the United States government is betting you 160 acres of land that you can't live on it 8 months. Ida and I weren't betting. We were holding on, living down to the grassroots. The big problem was no longer how to get off the homestead, but how to keep soul and body together on it. Edith and Ida weren't the first or the last single women 21 years or older to try their hands at and be challenged by homesteading Western lands. The 1862 Homestead Act, and later the Kincaid Act of 1904 that doubled the homestead from 160 to 320 acres, gave single, widowed, divorced, and abandoned women the right to homestead. And they did it successfully at a greater rate than men. Homesteading proved to be an acceptable enterprise for single women. Married women could keep their claims after marriage in the West, and those who settled the West outside of homesteading or were married had fewer rights under the law and in the courts. In the post-Civil War Gilded Age era, pioneer women fought for suffrage, labor laws, religious and educational freedom, and regulations for food production and medicine. They were leaders in the anti-saloon movement and pushed for laws against gambling and prostitution. In 1919, prohibition became the law of the land with the 18th Amendment, and a year later, women gained the vote with the 19th Amendment. While many of these rights took years to pass, women, especially minority women of the West, have had to fight even harder for equality in the 20th and 21st centuries. We celebrate these Western women who, when down to the grassroots, did not pull up stakes, but instead discovered their animal instinct of survival. Now here's a story from True West, the publication from May 2020. The Mule Shoe Ranch. The early history of the old Mule Shoe Ranch reads like something out of a Louis L'Amour shoot-em-up. It was also the stuff that inspires a visiting writer to write a Broadway play that eventually becomes a hit movie. Dr. Glendy King was the first to settle at what became the Mule Shoe in 1875. Suffering from tuberculosis, he had moved from New York to Tres Alamos, just north of Benson, in hopes the dry climate would cure his tuberculosis. He was a bitter man. Earlier, he had watched helplessly as his son died of the lung disease, and soon after that, his wife. At Tres Alamos, King heard the old-timers talk about a hospital set up by the Army back in 1862 at some hot springs in the Galiuro Mountains to the north. According to them, the 115-degree water cured the aches and pains of rheumatism and arthritis. After the Army abandoned the area, it remained unclaimed. King rode out to explore and found his Shangri-La in the desert country. He filed a 160-acre homestead claim and pitched a tent. In time, his health was restored, and he made plans to use the springs commercially. In the meantime, he became a rancher. In 1876, Apache marauders killed some 20 settlers in the Sulphur Springs and San Pedro River valleys, causing King to abandon his springs and seek refuge at Tres Alamos. After the Apache were removed to a reservation, ranchers and prospectors came in looking for places to graze cattle and stake claims. Following on their boot heels were packs of outlaws and cattle rustlers who sought a safe refuge in the rugged Galiuro Mountains. One of King's cowboys was found hanged along the trail. Fences were cut and cattle stolen. Following the arrival of the Southern Pacific Railroad in 1880, wealthy guests, lured by newspaper articles about the therapeutic springs, began to arrive. They got off the train at Wilcox and then rode a stagecoach to the hot springs. By 1882, the first permanent buildings were established. Still, outlaw gangs forced King to retreat again, this time to Benson. Tired of the lawlessness, King tried to sell but had no takers. Ironically, his worst trouble was with neighbors. A family named Jones had squatted on what King considered his land, and by 1884, the dissension had become a full-fledged feud. The feud reached its climax on August 28, 1884, when the Jones outfit and Ed Drew were driving some horses through Bass Canyon. King ordered his men to block the trail. A fight ensued, and King drew his knife and stabbed one of the squatters. Then drew his pistol and aimed it at Melvin Jones, who pulled out his Winchester and fatally wounded King. A coroner's jury from Tombstone ruled itself defense. Afterwards, King's family put the ranch up for sale. The next owner of the Mule Shoe was the storied cattle baron, Henry Clay Hooker. He bought it in 1884 for $1,050. With the ranch, Hooker acquired the Therapeutic Hot Springs, where Apache warriors used to pause from their raiding to soothe their aching muscles in the therapeutic waters and bathe in the warm mud. Hooker went to work developing the ranch, building a cook shack, bathhouse, and enlarging the main house. He invited guests to rest their weary bodies in the hot springs, which he renamed Hooker's Hot Springs. He claimed the water would cure everything, from rheumatism to acne. By 1889, there were so many guests at the hot springs, the place even had its own post office. Augustus Thomas, a famous playwright, was one of the guests. In 1889, he wrote a Broadway hit, Arizona, based on the Hooker outfit. It was later made into a movie, 'Neath Arizona Skies, starring John Wayne. Forestine Hooker, Henry's daughter-in-law, wrote the novel The Long Dim Trail, based on her life at Hooker's Hot Springs. The ranch acquired its brand, the Mule Shoe Quarter Circle, in 1891, following the acquisition of a neighboring ranch after its previous owner was being harassed by friends of a man he killed in a gunfight. The Hooker family sold the Mule Shoe in 1906 to a Philadelphian, Deming Isaacson, who soon fell on hard times. He sold it to a wealthy divorcee from Cleveland, Jessica Wakin McMurray. She used it to entertain friends and turned it into a popular guest ranch. The Mule Shoe went through several more owners before the nonprofit Nature Conservancy bought the ranch in 1982. Today, it's home to a large variety of wildlife species, some endangered, who thrive on the isolated ranch that still requires a 30-mile ride on a dirt road to get there. Here's an article from True West's June 2020 edition, Gunpowder to Oysters, by Sherry Monahan. I know it sounds like the start of a bad joke, but they all did. During the 19th century, they frequented the local grocer, mercantile, or family goods store. Most carried produce, canned goods, dried foods, spices, coffee, flour, and anything food-related. Many sold gunpowder, coal, oil, and dynamite right alongside onions and oysters. Pioneers planned their day to include a visit to the store to gather the ingredients for meals and other household items. In Little Rock, Arkansas, shoppers could find flour, lard, hams, sugar, syrup, butter, jellies, and candies right alongside coal oil, soap, candles, and vinegar. According to an advertisement in the March 29, 1870 edition of the Daily Arkansas Gazette, customers could also pick up some hay, bran, and oats, along with 1,001 other things. At Nat and Hammond's in Stockton, California, pioneers chose from groceries cement, plaster of Paris, fire bricks, nails, and crockery. Carney Finland and Company in Leavenworth, Kansas, offered 8 types of sugar, including New Orleans, loaf, crushed, and powdered. They sold coffee, nuts, canned fruits, sauces, soap, candles, crackers, tea, nails, and wrapping paper. Lincoln, Nebraska's Good Luck Grocery offered quite a selection of high-end provisions in 1883. They advertised everything in the grocery line to be found in a first-class house. Prices guaranteed lower than any other house in the city. They sold Eagle condensed milk, Spanish olives, French peas, fresh oysters, royal baked macaroni, Italian salad oil, Batavia canned goods, Cross and Blackwell's pickles, Anderson's bulk preserves, Scotch orange marmalade, New York cream cheese, British salt, Max milk chocolate, imported Edam and Parmesan cheese, and several types of coffee. They sold Tebbets Arabian Mixture, Arbuckle's Ariosa, Dilworth's Java, Levering's Roasted Rio, OG Mandeling's Green Java, and Arbuckle's Pasca Roasted Coffee. Coffee was a big deal on the frontier, and in the early days, it was sold green and had to be roasted before it was ground and brewed for a hot beverage. Mercantile stores often advertised when they received a coffee grinder and offered roasted coffee for sale. Ricker and Lee in Galveston, Texas noted, "They were roasters of coffee and grinders of spices. It was much easier to just brew up that steaming cup if all the hard work was done for you." Grocers in Caldwell, Idaho assured their customers, "No more swearing over the old coffee grinder on cold mornings." Stiles and Dunbar grind all coffee purchased of them free. The Daily Huronite in Huron, South Dakota, reported, "In one of the store windows of Colquard and Richardson's grocery establishment is a water motor that runs their coffee grinder. It is a little daisy, and it does work well." The Cook City store in Montana began in 1886 and still operates today. If you want to step back in time, this is your chance. Not much has changed inside, and they still have the same display counters as well as old equipment. Even though shoppers' tastes have changed, you can still get some penny candy from old barrels. Here's a story from the July-August 2020 edition. "A Plague Hits Close to Home" by Bob Bowes-Bell. As the family story goes, in the summer of 1905, when my grandfather Robert Guess was a teenager, he contracted diphtheria while tending cattle at a remote waterhole and became so sick he couldn't remount his horse. A traveling family found him and helped him onto his horse, and he rode home, only to contaminate his two sisters with the dreaded plague. His sisters, Lori Pearl Guess, age 10, and Sadie Arcane Guess, age 7, both died from the deadly disease, along with a brother, Reuben Levi Guess, age 3, and were buried in the Orange, New Mexico cemetery with a temporary marker that misspelled their surname as Guest, G-U-E-S-T, children. While growing up, my grandmother often told this story and hoped that someday someone in our family would find those graves and give them a proper headstone. In 1991, I flew my mother and her older sister, Sadie Pearl, named for the two sisters, and my two kids to El Paso, where we rented a car, bought a bag of cement, and drove out past Cornuda's and Del City, Texas, to the Orange Cemetery, where we mounted a proper headstone on their graves. We knew the general location of the Orange Cemetery from a topo map, but luckily, a waitress in Cornuda's, Texas, drew us a map of the right back roads to take to find the graves. We wouldn't have found it without her directions. Overwhelmed with emotion, Sadie Pearl reacted to finally being able to honor the two Guess girls she was named for. "I kept the original marker, and I often look at it in my studio to remind myself of the sacrifice made by so many women in the settling of the West. I love their bravery and their tenacity, and in this issue, you will meet more just like them." True West Moments by Bob Bowes-Bell. Apache Endurance. Captured by Sonoran mercenaries near Escuela, Sonora, Mexico, south of the present-day Douglas, Arizona, in the mid-1860s, Dilthy was sold into slavery and shipped to the Baja Peninsula, where she ended up as an indentured servant at a hacienda. She and several others escaped, outrunning and outsmarting their mounted search parties sent to track them down. Crossing the Colorado River near Yuma, she couldn't swim, Dilthy evaded ambush by Yuma raiders and made it to her Warm Springs Apache family. She had walked more than 1,000 miles. Through it all, she carried no map, no weapons, and almost no provisions. What iron will she possessed! An Old West Scourge. As dangerous as the Wild West was, all the battles and armed conflicts paled when compared to the deadly foe of smallpox. An airborne scourge for centuries, smallpox arrived in the New World with the Spanish in 1509 and spread from the Caribbean to the North American Indian population, where it decimated entire tribes. Although vaccination campaigns began in the early 1800s, the disease was not eradicated until the 1970s. Not-so-gentle tamers. Although some have portrayed early Arizona pioneer women as being gentle tamers, the term does a bit of disservice to the toughness of these women, whether they were wrangling ornery kids or dispatching hogs, chickens, scorpions, and rattlesnakes. The women who lived in Arizona territory had to be tough. We, their offspring, admire and thank them for their grit. 30 Love at Fort Apache. In 1874, newlywed Martha Summerhays accompanied her soldier husband on a grueling 3-month journey from Fort Russell, Wyoming, to Arizona, where he had been transferred. The couple traveled by train to San Francisco, California, by packet to Cabo San Lucas and Guaymas, by steamer to Yuma, Arizona, and Fort Mojave, and finally by wagon, he walked, to Fort Whipple, Fort Verde, up the Mogollon Rim, and on to the lonely outpost called Fort Apache. Pregnant with her first child, Martha unpacked, then ventured out to see what the other wives were doing. To her surprise, she found a young lieutenant's wife playing tennis. Yes, tennis in the wilds of Arizona in 1874. Smashing. Battle-tested, battle-scarred, by John Langelier. On June 25, 1876, the 7th U.S. Cavalry crossed the Wolf Mountains and moved into the Valley of the Little Bighorn. Custer was confident of his ability to handle whatever he ran up against, convinced that the Indians would follow their usual practice of scattering before a show of force, and completely unaware that he was descending upon one of the largest concentrations of hostile American Indian tribes ever assembled on the plains. Perhaps as many as 6,000 to 7,000 Sioux in northern Cheyenne, with as many as 2,000 warriors under such capable leaders as Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, Gall, Crow King, Lame Deer, Hump, and Two Moon, confronted Custer in the Battle of the Little Bighorn. The foot soldiers were armed with updated Springfield Model 1873 rifles, and mounted troopers carried carbines. Both were provided with ample ammunition. Around noon on this Saturday in June, Custer dispatched Captain Frederick W. Benteen, leading three companies to scout to the left of the command. This was not an unusual move for a force still attempting to fix the location of an elusive enemy and expecting him to slip away on contact. It is also possible that Custer, knowing the value of the principle of surprise, hoped to catch his foe unawares. At about 12:30 p.m., still 2 miles short of the river when the upper end of a village came into view, Custer advanced three more companies under Reno with instructions to cross the river and charge the American Indian camp. With five companies, Custer moved off to the right, still screened by a fold of ground preventing him from observing the extent of his opposition. Perhaps he thought he was to hit the Indians from the flank, letting Reno hold the enemy by the nose while Custer kicked him in the seat of his pants. As Custer progressed, he rushed Sergeant Daniel Knipe to the rear to hurry the pack train and its reinforced one company escort, urging it forward into what soon erupted into a firefight. Shortly afterward, he dispatched Trumpeter John Martin, also known as the Italian-born Giovanni Martino, with a last message to Benteen that a big village lay ahead and to be quick, bring packs, which would have contained important extra ammunition if the firefight had lasted any length of time, which it did not. Indeed, the main phase of the Battle of the Little Bighorn ended in something like 2 hours or less. Reno, charging down the river with his three companies and some Arikara scouts, ran into hordes of American Indians, not retreating, but advancing, perhaps mindful of their credible performance against Crook the week before, and certainly motivated by a desire to protect their women and children and cover a withdrawal of the villages. Greatly outnumbered, suffering heavy casualties, and in danger of being overrun, Reno withdrew to the bluffs across the river and dug in. In the meantime, Custer and the five companies with him, about 230 strong, moved briskly along the bluffs above the river until, some 4 miles away, they were beyond supporting distance and out of sight of the rest of the command. They were brought to bay and overwhelmed by an Indian force that heavily outnumbered them. Many troopers were struck down before they could mount a defense. In the wake of the debacle, a shocked nation, including many of the U.S. Army, questioned the outcome. How could the boy general and his hard-riding elite 7th Cavalry be vanquished? Among the answers was a contention that firearms had played a major role in the Little Bighorn tragedy. Writing just 2 years after the battle from a fort in Montana that bore Custer's name, one officer repeated a theory that began to circulate with some elements of the Army. In an unsigned letter published in the Army and Navy Journal on November 30, 1878, he wrote, "When our men are engaged in actual combat with a wily foe, it would be nothing more than fair that our government should supply our soldiers with the best rifles and carbines in the civilized world. If we are several years behind in regards to best rifles, it is time for us to wake up and see if something cannot be done to place us on equal footing, not with civilized nations, but with red men themselves." What this critic and others failed to admit was, as First Lieutenant Holmes Offley Paulding, a surgeon who attended to the survivors of the slaughter, noted, "Cavalrymen, as a general thing, are about as well fitted to travel through hostile country as pulling infants." The fact was that during the second day of the Little Bighorn fight, officers with Major Reno's surrounded force had to give permission to their men to fire in order to conserve ammunition, as they realized most of the troopers were poor shots. Edward Godfrey, a lieutenant with the 7th Cavalry, later recalled seeing one of the men pull the trigger. There was a perceptible dropping of the muzzle and a flinch, but no report. He had forgotten to cock his piece. The trapdoor in tribal hands. Unlike the troops they faced, American Indians could not look to a central support system for the Springfield and other arms they obtained from the whites through diverse means. This meant that innovative methods of reloading ammunition and maintaining or repairing broken weapons relied on the creativity of each warrior. A fractured wrist with a stock could not be sent back to the arsenal for replacement. Wetted rawhide and perhaps glue made from bison and even a bit of stray wire might be wrapped around the break so the hard-to-obtain firearm could continue in service. Also, because the weapon was not government-issued, as it was to a soldier, but instead a personal piece of war regalia, it might be decorated with brass trade tacks, carvings, or other additions to distinguish it as the property of a proud fighting man and capable hunter. Proficiency with armaments of many kinds was a given for most tribesmen who gained honor from valor in warfare and raiding, as well as protecting their people and providing game to sustain them as a staple of their diets. This is not to say that American Indians were sharpshooters. Most had little or no understanding of the use of sights, and accuracy was not very good, especially if fired from a galloping horse or from underneath the animal's chest as it galloped, which was the practice of many of the plains warriors. Reno's defense. Midday on June 25, 1876, Colonel George Armstrong Custer had divided the regiment into three contingents, retaining the main body of five companies under his immediate control and splitting the remainder of his force into two other elements under Major Marcus Reno and Captain Frederick W. Benteen. Reno's battalion was the first to reach the edge of the Indian camp, where he dismounted his men in accordance with U.S. Army tactics of the time. One trooper was detailed to take his mount, and three others from his four-man squad to the rear, while his comrades, who now were on foot, fanned out with fellow troopers to move forward in single file toward their objective. Their single-shot model 1873 Springfield carbines, despite the contention that their cartridges frequently jammed in the breech, performed well. Unfortunately, Reno's battalion soon stirred up a hornet's nest of Sioux, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors, wielding an array of weapons from bows and arrows to war clubs, lances, and an assortment of firearms, including Winchesters. The warriors repulsed Reno's attack. Reno would join Benteen across the river on high ground, where the retreating survivors holed up for several days, avoiding the fate of Custer and his ill-fated followers, all of whom died after a brief, bloody last stand. John P. Langelier specializes in U.S. military history of the Victorian and Edwardian eras. Battle-tested, battle-scarred is excerpted from his book, The Trapdoor Springfield, From the Little Big Horn to San Juan Hill. Offspring Publishing, Oxford, UK, 2018. When Whiskey Ruled the West, by Sherry Monahan. Whiskey's role in shaping the West and its rise to prominence over rum or vodka has its roots in the early days of the United States. Its story began with early colonists who learned to distill spirits from their new agricultural bounty of corn, wheat, barley, and rye. That continued with our founding fathers, which led to the Whiskey Rebellion. Whiskey also has strong ties to early explorers, mountain men, pioneers, the railroads, and more. It was sold as medicine, used to barter with, and fueled the temperance movement. Because whiskey's main ingredients were easily grown all over North America, the art of distilling spread as rapidly as settlers into newly settled regions. Whiskey was quick and easy to produce, and distilling grains into alcohol made them more valuable, more transportable, and more easily stored for long periods. The popularity of whiskey grew, and as whiskey's popularity increased, so did its value as a trade good. Whiskey on the Frontier. Early explorers Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, and Zebulon Pike took whiskey along with them on their expeditions. In addition to its being a standard army ration, it was used as a reward for their men and for trading purposes. By the time Lewis and Clark set off on their expedition, the Indians, along their planned route, were already accustomed to the use of whiskey as a trade good, and, in fact, demanded it. French-Canadian traders had already established the whiskey negotiation as part of their regular commerce with the tribes they encountered. Major Thomas Biddle, who would be on the later Yellowstone expedition up the Missouri, wrote, "So violent is the attachment of the Indian for it, liquor, that he who gives most is sure to obtain furs, while should anyone attempt to trade without it, he is sure of losing ground with this antagonist. No bargain is ever made without it." Later trappers like Jim Bridger, Kit Carson, James Beckworth, and Jedediah Smith carried it with them as a trade good after they, too, learned that the native peoples wouldn't trade with them if they didn't include whiskey in the bargaining process. Beckworth recalled a trading rendezvous. The absent parties began to arrive, one after the other, at the rendezvous. Shortly after, General Ashley and Mr. Sublette came in, accompanied with 300 pack mules, well laden with goods and all things necessary for the mountaineers and the Indian trade. It may well be supposed that the arrival of such a vast amount of luxuries from the East did not pass off without a general celebration. Mirth, songs, dancing, shouting, trading, running, jumping, singing, racing, target shooting, yarns, frolic, with all sorts of extravagances that white men or Indians could invent, were freely indulged in. The unpacking of the medicine water contributed not a little to the heightening of our festivities. Missouri played an important role in settling the West. It served as a starting point for traders and pioneers in wagons, where goods of all kinds were shipped up the Missouri River to the West, and it served as a major hub for the whiskey business. It's where most of the immigrant trails began, including the Santa Fe in Oregon. As a flood of immigrants rolled their wagons, hand carts, and livestock across the West, the lives of the people who already called the West home would never be the same. Whiskey's popularity as a trade good made it an essential tool in opening up new territory, but its influence compounded the damage that was immigration's legacy for Native peoples. In 1833, whiskey was trading at $5 per pint or $40 per gallon. The cost for whiskey in New York was between $29 and $36 per gallon. In today's money, $40 would be about $990. Supply and demand ruled, and whiskey became a hot commodity. Distillers and others in the business in Missouri enjoyed a good trade in the late 1860s and early 1870s because they were able to ship products to many Western cities from the port city of St. Louis. The Insatiable West. As whiskey became more profitable as a commodity, producers had a hard time keeping up with demand. Businessmen who wanted to turn a quick profit and fill their coffers created rectified whiskey products that were watered down or doctored with other cheaper ingredients like tobacco juice, kerosene, or grain alcohol. Hence the term rot gut. Straight whiskey was aged in new oak barrels for a minimum of 2 years, whereas rectified whiskey was usually consumed immediately, requiring no aging, and was often further distilled. Many whiskey peddlers and saloon owners made their own version of whiskey. Elixirs and bitters were also available and were another common way that both men and women pioneers could get drunk. With its value as a trade commodity firmly established in the West, it was only natural that as the frontier expanded, so did whiskey-based entrepreneurship. Pioneers opened a variety of whiskey-related businesses, and a host of other enterprises were formed in the West to support its swelling population. Businesses like stagecoaches, freighters, glass and bottle companies, barrel makers, distributors, hotels, railroads, cities, gamblers, distillers, mining, salesmen, and saloons all thrived because of whiskey. Boom and bust. Businesses all across the West boomed with whiskey, but none more than the saloons, dance halls, and brothels. Other than the distillers themselves, the men and women involved in these businesses undoubtedly had the biggest connection to, and profited the most from, whiskey's influence. They were the epicenter of most towns, the place where men gathered to get their news, talk politics, and unwind, further establishing whiskey's influence in the shaping of the West. In money towns like Tombstone, Arizona, Virginia City, Nevada, or Dodge City, Kansas, popular whiskey drinks of the day included whiskey cocktails, whiskey slings, whiskey punches, rock and rye, and stone fences. Only in rural or poorer towns would saloon owners serve their customers a simple shot of rot gut or cheap whiskey in dimly lit, ramshackle watering holes. Whiskey had become the popular tipple of the American West, but its rise was about to fall. As the turn of the century neared, so did the push for regulation and temperance. The Bottled in Bond Act was enacted in 1897 because, until then, the government did not regulate what was put in whiskey bottles and sold to the public. The act was a significant regulatory reform and ensured that 100% of the liquid sold as single malt whiskey was distilled in the same distilling season by a single distiller, and that the spirit had been aged for a minimum of 4 years in a federally bonded warehouse. The Women's Christian Temperance Union had been created in the 1870s and was pushing for prohibition. State prohibition laws and eventually national prohibition were passed and brought another chapter of scrutiny, economics, and opportunities to control markets. When the repeal of prohibition allowed whiskey back on the market, it was regulated and mass-produced, and the love affair between the American West and whiskey was all but over. Whiskey in the West today. Today, that's all changed, and America is back in love with the golden elixir. The whiskey industry is experiencing a renaissance of distillers and their spirits, and a significant number of distillers are now located in the American West. Single barrel bourbons, single malt scotches, whiskey festivals with educational whiskey seminars, whiskey magazines, and much improved and expanded distillery tours are paving the way for the small batch distiller and the American brown spirits revival. Small batch distillers are being propelled by a combination of modern trends in consumer products, including celebrating local heritage and interest in unique artisanal products. The emphasis on buying quality local products from people who share details about their origins also plays a role. Novel product innovations have also allowed the smaller distilleries to gain recognition. Some of today's artesian distillers are experimenting with blue corn, oats, quinoa, amaranth, and other exotic ingredients. Balcones Distilling in Waco, Texas, created its baby blue whiskey from roasted heirloom blue corn, and its brimstone whiskey is smoked with sun-baked Texas scrub oak. While some distillers are using exotic ingredients that the pioneers didn't even know existed, others are using technological distilling methods. It's quite possible that Western Frontier whiskey makers may have experimented with the maturation process by adding smoked wood chips or tree bark to the barrel to speed the flavor process, as is being done today at Boot Hill Distillery in Dodge City, Kansas. It uses 75% corn, 25% wheat whiskey mash, and it is aged in 30-gallon barrels for a month with added oak spirals for extra infusion. The modern trend in Western whiskey making is not to return to quantity and lower cost, but to emphasize quality and innovation. Sherry Monahan has been writing about food and beverage on the frontier since 1998. She was curious about why whiskey and not rum or vodka is associated with the West. That led her to write a book titled Golden Elixir of the West, which explores that and a whole lot more about whiskey in the West. Lubbock, Texas, by Leo W. Banks. Thomas Saltus Lubbock was a man of adventure and action. He fought for Texas independence and served with a Confederate cavalry unit in the First Battle of the Bull Run in 1861. He died of typhus the following year, but lives on in the West Texas town named for him at its 1890 founding. Farming, ranching, and the railroad helped Lubbock to become the so-called Hub City. Home to Texas Tech University, the High Plains community today is a center for art, culture, history, and especially music. "We're far from the dusty western town of popular image," says Christy Cavanis, director of marketing and communication for Lubbock Economic Development Alliance. "We attract 6 million visitors a year, but we still feel like a small town. Lubbock is a big city with little city love." The area's music history traces to rock and roll icon Buddy Holly, born in Lubbock in 1936. The Buddy Holly Center tells his story through an array of memorabilia, from tour itineraries, stage clothes, and fan letters, to his Fender Stratocaster guitar. In the foyer, see a replica of Holly's model J200 Gibson guitar signed by Sir Paul McCartney. Outside stands a large sculpture of Holly's signature horn-rimmed glasses. We have live music in bars and restaurants 7 nights a week, says Cavanis, adding that the Buddy Holly Hall of Performing Arts and Science is expected to open downtown in September. The National Ranching Heritage Center boasts 50 historic structures, dating from the 1780s to the 1950s, that have been relocated, restored, and furnished to their time period. Walk the 27-acre grounds, smartphone in hand, to see photos and listen to stories about each building. The center's 44,000-square-foot museum has an exhibit on Charles Goodnight, the most famous Texas rancher of them all. The Saddlemaker's Room showcases the work of some of Texas's greatest craftsmen, including Carl Darr, who made 1,586 saddles in his storied career. On the first Friday of every month, walk downtown's First Friday Art Trail to visit galleries showing the work of talented local artisans. The Caviel Museum of African American History opens during the art trail. Billy and Alfred Caviel operated a pharmacy in Lubbock for 49 years and hoped their building would eventually become a museum. It opened in 2015 and displays artwork and photos that speak to an often unknown side of West Texas culture. The Depot Entertainment District features live music at venues like the Cactus Theater, which opened in 1938. Songwriters gather at the Blue Light Live every Monday to show their talent, and in October and November, the club hosts a popular singer-songwriter competition. The Joint Hops, the Goatees alone, are worth a look. West Texas produces 90% of the state's wine grapes, which means plenty of wineries to tour. McPherson Cellars hosts patio nights in the warm weather. Sip one of its award-winning wines while listening to, yes, more live music. At Flint Custom Hat Shop, get your old model blocked and resized, or get fitted for a brand new flat-brimmed straw job. Owner Jared Kelsley makes every hat by hand and takes great care with his creations. The Silent Wings Museum honors World War II glider pilots, most of whom were trained in Lubbock. Watch a short documentary, walk through an interactive gallery to get a feel for combat, and peer inside a glider suspended from the ceiling. In the Davies Gallery at the Museum of Texas Tech University, see an extensive collection of American Indian pottery and handmade rugs. Lubbock Lake Landmark explains 12,000 years of human habitation in the area. Take one of its popular night hikes under a star-filled sky through Yellow Horse Draw. Fun fact, Buddy Holly co-wrote his 1957 hit song, That'll Be the Day, after hearing John Wayne use the line several times in his classic western, The Searchers. Leo W. Banks is an award-winning writer based in Tucson. His newest mystery novel is titled Champagne Cowboys.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been...
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 86 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus Updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
The Little Old Lady Who Broke All the Rules by Katharina Engelmann Sundby. read by Patience Tomlinson. Chapter 25. Chief Inspector Pettersson found it incomprehensible. Two valuable paintings had been stolen from the National Museum, and although the police had set up roadblocks, checked all the passengers on trains and planes,